Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to welcome you all to another one of our golf roundtables. As you know, we have these meetings about once a month with the generous support of the UAE Embassy. And we have a presentation today that a couple of presentations I've really been looking forward to talking about. There's not a lot available in Washington on the Iranian Navy, and we have two people who I think are extraordinarily well-informed, well-prepared to talk to us about it. It plays off a paper that we just put out. There are hard copies outside. It's on the web. Send it to your friends. That Commander Josh Himes wrote, Iran's Maritime Evolution, which talks about how the Iranian Navy is structured, how it's been changing, and what it means for U.S. strategy. To kick us off today, we'll hear from Dr. David Crist, the senior historian for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. As a historian myself, I always kind of wondered if there really is a demand for historians. And David's CV is a sign that everybody wants David Crist to work in his staff. He started working for the Marine Corps, joined the Joint Staff, is now detailed down to General Mattis, the commander of CENTCOM. He's served with Special Operations Forces in both Afghanistan and Iraq, and he's currently finishing a book on America's undeclared war with Iran to be published by Penguin in the spring. After David sets us up, we'll hear from Josh Himes, a U.S. Navy fellow here at CSIS. I have had the pleasure of working with Josh for the last year. He's contributed to a number of different products, not just things we've done in the Middle East program, but elsewhere throughout CSIS. Prior to joining us, he serves as the Deputy Director for Intelligence at the National Military Command Center and helped prepare the Chairman and SecDef's daily intelligence update brief. He also deployed to the ISAF Joint Command in Kabul, Afghanistan. He's done operational tours with Carrier Air Wing 11 on the U.S. Abraham Lincoln and USS Kitty Hawk, and Carrier Strike Group 12, embarked on the infamous USS Enterprise. He has videos he'll show us afterwards. He's conducted multiple deployments in support of Operations Allied Force, Enduring Freedom, and Iraqi Freedom. And my understanding is you are about 2 weeks away from going to lovely, cool, beachfront Manama, Bahrain. As a Middle East specialist, I would tell you, don't go to the Gulf in the summer. That's the insider thing, yeah. Anyway, so we are delighted you're here. We'll first hear from David, and then we'll hear from Josh, and then we'll open up to questions. Just a note, because we do have two U.S. government officials, the prepared remarks will all be on the record. You can use it however you want. When we go to the question and answer, if we could keep that off the record, just to... If there are any indiscretions, keep all the indiscretions to yourself.
Thank you. Yeah, I thank you for the introduction. I am testament that there is a life as a beyond teaching world history surveys in community colleges, so I'm thankful for that, and my professor be damned. So what I want to talk about, which I hope will complement and not duplicate what Josh is going to talk about today, is the lessons learned from the last time the U.S. had a confrontation at sea with Iran, which was 20 years ago. I think most people in this audience are aware of that. I do this for a couple of reasons. One is since I'm so involved in the current thinking about Iran, it keeps me safe by talking about the past, and I believe we'll get across the points that I think are salient. Two, it's that conflict 20 years ago shaped the Iranian thinking about a future conflict. It provides a baseline and a template for how they will approach a future conflict, even with the changes in technology. Admiral Fadavi, the head of the Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy, was a young officer when the Vincennes shot down the Airbus. He was commanding the small boats in their engagement. His public and private statements have shown that he's never got over this. It was his Vietnam, and if he has a chance at a replay, he would like to see that before he retires. So it dominates the Iranians' thinking much more so than it does the U.S. And three, as you know, I'm a historian, and, well, when you invite Colonel Sanders, you're going to get a talk about chickens. So I just can't resist myself. There are a few reasons why we would have a confrontation with Iran at sea. The obvious one would be a reaction to a strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. That's one possibility. But less obvious, and I think equally as dangerous, is an unexpected escalation of hostilities. The possibility of a IRGC small boat harassment that they do periodically of a U.S. warship, exchange of gunfire, it quickly escalates. Within the last couple of months, there's been two very close overflights, one of the U.S. carrier by an Iranian aircraft. One was an overflight of a U.S. P-3 by an Iranian P-3, of all things. We're not sure whether this was just hot-dogging pilots or whether it was a concerted effort, but these things have the potential for a confrontation. And the IRGC's own philosophy, I think, aggravates this situation. They have a military doctrine that relies on decentralized command and control. So if there's a conflict at sea, there's a distinct possibility that even if Tehran wants to de-escalate it, they may not be able to. And the other one is they strongly reward initiative by their commanders. Most of you may know that the Iranian commander who seized the British sailors in 2007, he acted under no authority from Tehran. But he was it was probably the best career move he ever made. He's now a very senior commander in the Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy. And, of course, every aspiring and ambitious young officer notices that. So all these are problems. What a conflict would look like, I think, is anyone's guess. And opinions vary on the gambit. The U.S. Navy Fifth Fleet's view has always tried to downplay the likelihood of a conflict with Iran. And if there is one, it would be a very short-sighted affair, America's superiority of technology and air power would quickly overwhelm the Iranians. The previous NAVSENT commander used to use the term, quote, "it'll be like clubbing baby seals," to describe his fight with Iranian Navy and the IRGC small boats. I have no doubt it will be a one-sided affair, but I'm not so sure it'll be quite as easy as we like to think. We do have a historical case study that describes this and provides, I think, some insight in a potential future conflict. For over a year, from 1987 to 1988, the United States engaged in its only protracted military confrontation with Iran, called Operation Earnest Will. Conflict was primarily a naval one and centered around the U.S. decision to escort and safeguard Kuwaiti tankers amidst the Iran-Iraq war. While it culminated in April of 1988 with the U.S. Navy's largest surface engagement since World War II and a decisive defeat for the Iranian military, for the most part, it was waged tactically more akin to a counterinsurgency campaign than a traditional naval engagement. More reminiscent in many ways of Iraq or Afghanistan than one would think. The United States Central Command, or CENTCOM, developed a number of unique ways to deal with the largely asymmetrical threat posed by Iranian small boats and mines. I don't believe history repeats itself. The Gulf is far different today than it was 20 years ago. In fact, I think in both cases, both sides are much stronger than they were 20 years ago. But as I said in my opening statement, this conflict had a profound effect on the way Tehran views a future conflict. And they came away with the opinion from their conflict in 87 and 88 that their asymmetrical threat and doctrine was sound, but what they lacked was the technology and the means to properly implement it. And for Washington, I think it provides a good case study of how we might be able to defeat the Iranian asymmetrical threats. I'm not going to go into many of the details of the conflict, but let me lead off with an important idea, I think, which is in 1987, 7 years after the beginning of the Iran-Iraq War, Iran had a very limited capability to go after the U.S. convoy mission and the U.S. Navy in the Gulf. Their Air Force was a shadow of what had been under the Shah. The Navy had huge problems. So as a result, Iran is acutely aware of the disparity in combat power. So as a result, what they do is they rely on asymmetrical attacks, primarily terrorism and naval mining. And these provide a degree of plausible deniability. They hope, particularly with using naval mines, that they can strike at the United States, inflict damage, but it'll be very difficult to prove that Iran had been behind it. So as a consequence, it's hard for the U.S. to retaliate in a manner that Iran knows it can't cope with. Because of their shortages in aircraft and the regular Navy, the Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy is founded in 1985, and by 1987 is the principal means by which Iran's attacking shipping headed to the supporters of Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, et cetera. It's an improvised fleet. If you can imagine, you know, your father's Boston Whaler with a rocket launcher mounted on the front, it's essentially what the Iranians are doing. This Mosquito fleet can't sink anything significant, but it can do enough damage. And they did do enough damage to U.S. warships or to tankers. And they operated from a sort of a unique concept. It was a series of forward operating bases. The Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy's then and now, their main bases are in Bandar Abbas and Bushehr. But then they would have islands. They would use Abu Musa, Farsi Island, Siri, these as forward operating bases would allow these small boats, which don't have much staying power in the sea, to project power into the middle of the Gulf to intimidate the Gulf Arabs. Mines were a big part of this plan, again, because of the plausible deniability. But these are really unsophisticated mines. They were a pre-World War I Russian mine that they had purchased some from the North Koreans with a little help from our friend Muammar Gaddafi. Reverse engineered them and started manufacturing them. You physically have to hit them to do any damage. But they proved remarkably effective. From May of 87, when they laid their first mine, to April of 1988, when they laid their last, Iran laid 91 of these mines in 6 separate attacks directed at U.S. forces. Nearly 1 in 10 found a target. And for the cost of $1,500 World War I era mine, they inflicted enough damage to nearly sink what today would be a $1 billion U.S. Navy warship. Pretty good bang for the buck. Now, CENTCOM made a fundamental failure on their assumption going into this conflict. They had assumed that the U.S. Navy carrier presence, which had been out there, occasionally they would have 2 carriers in the Gulf of Oman, would intimidate the Iranians so they wouldn't take the United States on. But it fails. In fact, it fails on the very first American convoy when one of them hits an Iranian mine laid the night before. So this idea of carrier intimidating the Iranians failed. And that was a lesson I think CENTCOM will internalize. In response to these Iranian attacks, small boat and minings, rather than sort of a traditional naval operation, CENTCOM, with a lot of support from Admiral Corral, who was the chairman at the time, developed a concept that's based on land-based counterinsurgency approach. And the analogy I always make, since everybody, at least in Washington, has been the last 10 years, is focused heavily on counterinsurgency doctrine and Iraq and Afghanistan, is think of how you would guard the main road that runs from Kuwait up to Baghdad on land versus IEDs or insurgent attacks. And essentially you have the same thing on water, which is a tanker route or a tanker traffic route that goes through the Gulf through some series of checkpoints you can't get around. So how do you do that? Well, what the CENTCOM did is they relied on intelligence, better intelligence assets, constant surveillance, and constant patrol presence along this 500-mile route. So you have helicopters, you have SR-71s, you have boats pre-staged along this route that can provide a constant presence so you can watch what the Iranians are bringing in along the shipping routes, keep tabs of suspicious small boat activities, and make sure they don't mine or don't attack neutral shipping. Up in the north, our good friends at Halliburton provided a huge barge that was about 400 feet long designed to build offshore oil platforms. It's turned into a special forces base, patrol base, with helicopters and SEALs and patrol boats, all to have a presence up in the northern Gulf to keep the Iranians from doing this. And it's very effective. By the end of the conflict, the U.S. had effectively shut down Iranian mining and, for the most part, their small boat activities. So what does Iran learn from this confrontation? Well, Iran learns a couple of key lessons, and there is a meeting, probably more meetings, but it's the one that I'm aware of and got it run through a D-class process a year or so ago. In the spring of 1981, there's a meeting in Tehran, and it's right after Desert Storm. And Mohsen Rezaei, who's the head of the Revolutionary Guard at the time, heads the meeting. But there's representatives from the Navy and other pieces of the armed forces. And what they're looking at is what lessons can they learn from the recent conflict, not only against the United States in the 80s, but Desert Storm. And Iran has periodically done this. They've done this after 2003. They've done it, I think, even more recently. To look at how the U.S. does actions and how that might impact them and how they can adapt their own strategy to meet what they see as increasing U.S. technology capabilities. And what the Iranians came away during this meeting in Tehran is something that I think is still valid, which is that their strategy had been correct, but they had lacked the capabilities to really execute this against the U.S. This confrontation with the U.S. and the Gulf showed that they can't compete with and force-on-force with the U.S. Navy, that building larger conventional warships such as the Shah did plays to the U.S. strength. But what the U.S. can't cope with or has struggles with is indiscriminate mining, small boat harassment, swarm tactics, these sorts of things, because large warships don't have the defense capabilities in their mind, and they're big, huge, dumb targets. Fadavi's had a statement a year ago when there was discussion about a second American aircraft carrier went in the Gulf to support Afghanistan or so, and it was asked, does this intimidate you, Iranian media? And his response is, no, it's another big target for us. And so that's his approach to this problem. And what they couldn't do in the 80s that they can do now is I wouldn't say perfected, but they've improved an idea of a swarm tactics on a warship. So these small boats are no longer just out, you know, John boats with a rocket on it, but they're now missile boats, they're torpedo boats, they're the potential submarines, plus, you know, the John boat with a rocket launch that they still have 1,000 of. But if they can converge all these on a U.S. warship simultaneously, they present the U.S. in a problem. What does he dress? How does he deal with torpedoes coming at the same time as missiles, coming out as a guy with a rocket launcher or a machine gun who may damage his sensor system? So all these things can be thrown together. And so this is it's a logical extension to their tactics in the 80s, and this is kind of their approach. Mining, according to open sources, the Iran currently has is between 3,000 and 5,000 mines today. Most of these are still old contact mines, but there's perhaps 300 that are very sophisticated influence mines that can lay on the bottom of the Strait of Hormuz and pick up American warships or whatever they want to target and hit them. Far more sophisticated threat. Plus, they've adapted submarines, the Kilo submarines, the increasing number of the Ono, which are the small submarines similar to the one that sank the South Korean warship. All of these add a certain degree of stealthiness in their attacks. And if they can ever combine them, which is what their hope is, it would be, a formidable threat. A critical shortfall in the 1980s that they recognized was they lacked a real commando capability, SEALs in U.S. terms, the ability to conduct sabotage attacks and through swimmers and remote delivery vehicles, these sorts of things. They didn't have it in the 80s, but it has been an effort since the 1990s to look at developing underwater submersible vehicles. In the 1990s, they experimented with using commercial ships that they could launch commandos from, so you could theoretically steam close to either a U.S. base or an Arab country in their harbor and launch these guys out, and it would be hard to detect where they came from, that kind of thing. Now, U.S. lessons. We're not always the best at learning our own lessons sometimes, which I find disheartening as a historian when the adversary is sometimes a little better at it than we are. But there are a number of key takeaways that as the U.S. looks at how you deal with the Iranian doctrine. It shows, some important ideas. One is that Iran is willing to escalate and take risk in confronting the U.S. It was something that was an assumption that was made that was wrong early, and I think Iran can push the envelope sometimes. Iran has a tendency to view that their revolutionary zeal in numbers will make up for lack of tactical and technical sophistication. The swarm tactics are a good example of that. You can overwhelm them with different sorts of, in some cases, not too sophisticated threats. And the U.S., while we're vastly superior technologically, we can't cope with that unsophisticated threat. And in some ways, I think the insurgency in Iraq has reinforced some of these ideas in their mind. On the positive, use of force against Iran worked. I would make a parallel to what we did rolling up the Quds forces in Iraq after the EFP issue came, to the notion that going after them militarily for the mine lane, there is a certain parallel. And in both cases, it had a desired effect on changing Iranian behavior, at least temporarily. So the idea of force did work. And I think last is CENTCOM has to anticipate this unconventional threat, has to be prepared to deal with the idea of indiscriminate mining and neutral shipping, the idea of sabotage, of commandos blowing up things unexpectedly, oil infrastructure, not necessarily just U.S. forces, but our allies and friends in the region. And to combat this, it needs a coalition effort. For example, during Ernest Will, it required about 15 minesweepers to deal with Iranian mine threat, permanently deployed in the Gulf. The U.S. has four there today. And the U.S. capability of sustaining that many just doesn't exist. You have to rely on allies. And the Europeans have some very good assets, as do some of the Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, for example. So there has to be a partnership to deal with this. And I think if there's mining of international waters, you will have that agreement. And that's it. There's a lot more I could talk about, but we can go on those in questions.
So. Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. Just two quick points for context. So I'm here for a year as a military fellow, heading back to the fleet in a week and to the region. Last spent time in Bahrain in 05, deployed in 06, supporting OEF, OIF, and pretty interesting time in the Iranian context, simply because you had the UNSC looking at the nuclear portfolio, you had sanctions, a lot of things that sort of ratcheted up pressure on Iran. So as I left that focus and went to do other things, coming back, basically the reason I looked at this topic was I was curious what had changed in the 4 or 5 years since. And I found there was quite a bit. So that's what led me to sort of pull the string a little bit and get to the paper or the abbreviated version of the paper that you have here. Dave's covered the background history, so I won't go into to a lot of depth there, but I just want to point out one thing that's kind of unique that I think has driven the changes in the relationship that started in 07. Prior to the revolution, you had a conventional Iranian navy, some discussion in the 70s about a blue water sort of expanding capability to reflect the regional prominence of the Shah and the Iranian regime. Obviously, that didn't survive the revolution. The Revolutionary Guard Navy, specifically 1985, coming, and then you have a sharing of water space, which is pretty unusual to have two different maritime units operating in the same area. We obviously have a Coast Guard and Navy, but different missions, different areas. In this case, we had two units operating in the same place. As you can imagine, in addition to discussions about who gets money for what, just operating in the same place is not a convenient thing for two forces that had a very different perspective on how to operate. So in 2007, kind of following all the churn in 06 that I mentioned with the UNSC, with the arrival of General Jafari to run the Revolutionary Guard and some of his new ideas about asymmetric warfare, and don't forget OEF and OIF ongoing on either side of Iran, you had basically a reorganization that drove the regular Navy, conventional Navy, outside the Gulf into the Gulf of Oman and into the Caspian, and gave the IRGCN primacy in the Gulf itself. I think this probably did three things that make a lot of sense. The first thing it did was gave the Rev Guard Navy an opportunity to enhance their own natural skills as a small, fast, unconventional force in a very limited area, their own backyard, if you will. It also allowed the regular Navy, kind of a second advantage, a chance to move out into a more blue water environment to enhance the ability of their larger platforms to operate outside the confines of the Gulf. And the biggest thing I think that it added is you now have a much more complex defense in depth that you can provide. Traditionally, we've thought of the potential fight as being something that would be in the Strait of Hormuz with a kind of an overlapping threat defense, mines, coastal defense, cruise missiles, small boats. But now you have, if you're the Iranian military, you have the ability to push that threat out into the Gulf of Oman, further out, and defend at a much greater distance. So that's where we start in 07. And briefly, I'll talk about what the two forces bring to the table today and what I think is coming in the next few years as way by way of their strategy, and then just finish up with a couple of recommendations that I think need to be made. So the regular Navy, about 200 ships, about 18,000 personnel, significant in size if you just look at those numbers, but you need to remember that most of these ships were built back in the 60s and 70s, and they have not gotten the lion's share of the defense budget. That's gone to the Revolutionary Guard Navy. So they have been upgrading internally with the same hulls that they've had back in the day, with two primary exceptions. The first of those is their subsurface capability, and the second is their cruise missile capability. So in a sense, if you will, the asymmetric aspect of a conventional Navy have been where they've been able to put their money. The rest of the fleet, they've been basically, I'll say, hobby shopping for the most part. The other interesting thing about the regular Navy is, and this most folks back in 06, 07 would have said this wasn't possible, but you know, they've now done 14 patrols all the way down into the Gulf of Aden since 08. They've also now, with the arrival of 1 kilo in the Red Sea, expanded their operations into the Red Sea, and then they had the one trip back in February up to Syria, which they've already said they plan on doing again at a time, you know, of their choosing, but probably not when it not anytime soon, just based on the current situation in Syria. So they've been able, even with those limited assets, to expand where they're operating, and I'll talk about why I think that's important in a second. The Rev Guard Navy, on the other hand, probably about the same number of personnel, probably a couple thousand ships, but really 200 or 300 core ships that get to this complex irregular warfare capability, where it's not just guys in your uncle's Boston Whaler with a gun, but it's now torpedoes, it's now fairly advanced short-range cruise missiles, and some with both on boats that are now going 60, 80 knots instead of 35, 40 knots. So on the surface side, they have certainly taken advantage of the investment to build a fairly high-speed and somewhat more lethal deterrent force. And that continues. In fact, just in the past month, they've highlighted the fact that they picked up, I think from South Africa, a UK boat called the Blade Runner, which is one of these high-speed sport speedboats, 80, 85 knots. And they're now basically redesigning it internally, equipping it with anti-ship cruise missiles, you know, about 10 to 15 kilometer range, not long range, but certainly long enough to do what they need it to do. And now that's a domestic production line that they're going to do internally, which is going to make it a lot harder for us to track how many, where they operate, and that sort of thing. So they've been very busy at the moment. One of the questions I had when this reorganization happened and when I looked at it is, why would the regular Navy decide, if they even had the choice, to cede their role in the Gulf and move out? Because it you know, if they were already somewhat marginalized by the Revolutionary Guard, this certainly doesn't help their case when looking for money. So the one piece that I think makes sense as to why they would do that, in addition to the one I mentioned before about just the natural place you'd want larger ships to be, is this economic vision 2025, and it's a bit of a buzzword, but the idea that the Supreme Leader has directed the regular Navy to be a part of their economic and regional expansion to ensure that as they, you know, try and maintain their economic viability in light of sanctions and other things, they have a naval component that provides access to those areas. And, you know, they've quoted Mahan. They, I think, have read Kaplan's Monsoon just based on how they talk. But they talk about this strategic triangle that they need to operate in, which goes from the Strait of Hormuz out to the Strait of Malacca and to the Bab el-Mandeb, and that they need to have a regional influence in that area to ensure that goods, commerce, and the things that would drive their economy are maintained. So that, I think, is where the regular Navy is going to continue to go and be relevant. Because, frankly, you know, especially as David talks about the irregular warfare way that the Iranians approach this, I'm not sure the regular Navy is going to be particularly relevant if a fight goes kinetic. I mean, their assets are just too large and too vulnerable to what we can do. So I don't think there's going to be much of a role for them there. The other piece of what they've been doing, and this, you know, this may be part of the same expanded vision or just trying to make lemonade out of the lemons they've been handed, is regional outreach. They've spent time in places that I thought were a little, not sort of surprising, but pretty adventurous. Back in December, Admiral Sayari went down to Djibouti under more or less a pretext of supporting the anti-piracy operations that were ongoing, and inked some agreements for maintenance, logistics, training of the Djiboutians that's going to provide the Iranians a nice home away from home if they decide to expand operations out to the west in that area. There are exercises with the Omanis, Qataris, also play into that same idea of basically trying to expand their influence, particularly at a time where there's probably a lack of stability is the best term, with the Arab Spring ongoing or almost done, as Dr. Alterman said. And the Navy's a perfect platform to do that because it's not intrusive the way it would be with other parts of the military. And I think it's a nice balance between being overly aggressive and not having a presence. So I think that's where the Iranian Navy seems to be going. The Revolutionary Guard, I think, has got a pretty good focus on expanding their lethality and the complexity of their deterrence in the Gulf itself. I mentioned the missile shooters that they're now producing domestically. David mentioned the mine warfare and the cruise missiles. There's been a couple of interesting developments in the past few months that speak to, I think, where they're going. Up till now, the subsurface realm has been entirely the regular Navy. It's a level of training and sophistication that is just beyond what the Rev Guard has been able to do. Both General Jafari of the Rev Guard and Admiral Fadavi have said that they are going to start playing in the subsurface realm and taking some of these smaller Yonah-class submarines. They've also expanded their ability to search over the Gulf with more capable radars that they've built domestically. One of the knocks has always been, you have these ballistic missiles or you have these coastal defense cruise missiles that go out 60, 80, 100 miles, but you can't find anything. You don't have any kind of real over-the-horizon targeting capability or even geolocation. So they're starting to address that. And then the last one that is perhaps maybe a little more aspirational but I think is still coming is the smart anti-ship ballistic missile capability that they've talked about, where they've taken a FADA 110, a short-range ballistic missile, and adjusted the seeker on it to create something that potentially could go after ships. I don't think it's as advanced as they say, and typically the Iranians, especially around exercises, like to speak about their capabilities, and there's about, I would, if I had to put a number on it, about 20% of it has some relevance. The rest of it is bravado, but typically something comes to fruition there. So this is a capability that concerns me a little bit because it takes that complex irregular warfare, the asymmetric warfare piece, and takes it to a whole new level. Not saying this is a Chinese DF-21D kind of comparison. Certainly not. It doesn't appear to be like that. But it goes in that direction. So based on that kind of framework for where the two forces are going, and this is just my thoughts, certainly doesn't reflect the view of the Department of the Navy or DOD, a couple of things that I thought would be worthwhile for at least the U.S. Navy planners, if not, OSD planners to look at. The first, and Dave alluded to this, is, the Iranians like to call our carriers targets. I think there's some validity to that. It is a very large piece of steel that reflects radar quite well. I think the GCC has some capabilities that, in a sense, are more symmetric to what the Iranians have with patrol craft and corvettes and smaller ships that are of that asymmetric sort. So I think there needs to be a larger role that the GCC plays, and I think it needs to be maybe a niche capability. Mine warfare was one that I think Dave's mentioned we've got perhaps a lack there. That's maybe something that they could invest in greater to provide some capabilities. I know the Saudis have talked about potentially a BMD capability, buying an Aegis destroyer or going down that road. That may be a bit much, but certainly more than what has been happening to now needs to happen, especially in light of, the current domestic budget discussions and carrier strike groups potentially dropping as low as, pick a number that's been thrown around the hill, but 11 seems to be about as high as we'll ever get anytime soon. So I think there's a role the GCC needs to play that has not been played up to now simply because we've played that role. Another thing that concerns me is with one of the downsides in my mind of sanctions has been that the Iranians have just gone inward and they've decided, okay, the Russians won't sell us an air defense system. We'll go figure it out on our own. And the same goes for other areas. So as they focus on domestic production and doing things internally, we don't get, I think, a good sense as we would otherwise of what their capabilities are and what they have. And I'll give you an example. If let's say the Iranians develop a new corvette, as they have with the Jamaran or Moj frigate. Most of the radars and sensors on there are made domestically. So traditionally, we would have a good understanding of what radar parameters would be because it's built off of a Russian system or something that we've seen has been exported, we're pretty comfortable with. Now you've got new parameters on a radar. Maybe our prowlers are good for jamming it. Maybe they're not because we just don't know. So there's some things that leave me a little more worried than I perhaps would have been otherwise because of that movement to domestic production. The third recommendation, and this goes to Dave's point that I just think we need to adjust how we look at our operations and training in the Gulf and think about the capabilities that are either online or coming online because it's not the way it used to be, especially with the Rev Guard owning the entire Persian Gulf. And I'll give you a couple scenarios. Dave mentioned the first one I was going to mention, which was the whole miscalculation. Concerns have always been the Revolutionary Guard Navy is a little less professional, perhaps, than the regular Navy. Now with them owning the Gulf, is the chance for miscalculation greater than it was before 07? Potentially. There's two I worried about a little bit more, though, and the first of those is maybe it's in Iran's interest because of the environment, and they've done things like this before, to stir up something at a tactical level, do a first hit, provide a strategic theme that gives them some credibility as, the element of resistance in the region or pick kind of the piece that they would play and start with their obfuscation. After that, push back on the fact that we're not signed to UNCLOS, 312 nautical mile differences off the islands that we debate on, and then back off before it gets truly kinetic and gets to the point where we're clubbing baby seals, but gets at least that tactical hit to provide them some leverage in the region. And the third one I worry about, mines in the Strait of Hormuz. In fact, General Jafari just talked about it this past week after Noble Prophet 6 that's something they would consider. As the regular Navy has expanded into the places like the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea, I think something potentially more problematic is a mine in the Bab el-Mandeb. It doesn't interfere with what the Iranians are doing using the Strait, not choking off their economic lifeblood, but it provides just as much chaos in the international economic environment. And now that they have ships operating there, they're certainly on decent terms with Sudan and elements within Yemen. That's potentially a scenario we need to consider. And I don't think, at least on the naval side, we've really thought about threats in that part of the world. Typically, we transit with the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, and we're not too concerned about that sort of environment. And then the last recommendation, and this is probably a good way to transition to Q&A, since I suspect there's quite a bit of disagreement here. The fact that the regular Navy has now expanded out beyond just the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman and into areas where the rest of us operate, specifically anti-piracy missions in the Gulf of Aden, potentially there's an opportunity for communications through the Navy as a conduit to Tehran. It's a bit of a stretch. It's certainly in the current environment, it's probably not likely. But I think ultimately, if we're talking regional stability, you've got to have Iran playing some type of reasonably constructive role. I just don't see the status quo going forever. So I would submit that's maybe a step in that direction, albeit small. Whether we do anti-piracy ops as a way to work with their Navy or even some of the regional exercises, India, Pakistan both have some very large naval exercises, 20, 30 countries involved, where you could take a step in that direction. And with that, Grenade, I will pass it back.
Thank you.